Case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Transamerica Mortgage Advisors against Lewis. Anderson, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, it has been 6 months since this case first heard oral argument in this case, and for that reason, with the Court's permission, I will take a minute or two to offer a brief summary of the facts relevant to the issue again before this Court, namely whether a private right of action may be implied under the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. This Court learned last March this case came to court in April 1973 with a suit by the plaintiff and respondent, Harry Lewis, asking legal and equitable relief for alleged violation of the Investment Advisors Act. The petitioners moved to dismiss the complaint for failure to state a claim and argued that Mortgage Trust of America was and is a mortgage lender which does not deal in securities within the meaning of the federal securities laws, that Transamerica Mortgage Advisors, its advisor, is not a public investment advisor in any sense of that word, that the Investment Advisors Act of 1940 does not apply to the petitioners or to the facts of this case, that the respondent Lewis had failed to make proper demand on the trustees of Mortgage Trust of America, and that the Investment Advisors Act of 1940 does not afford a private right of action in any event. The District Court noted that the petitioners' arguments had what were called substantial merit, but ruled that since the Advisors Act does not afford a private right of action, that the other questions would not be decided. On appeal, petitioners again argued that the Investment Advisors Act does not apply to the petitioners or to the facts of this case, and that there is no private right of action. The Court of Appeals also declined to consider the other arguments just mentioned and ruled, with one judge dissenting, quote, implication of a private right of action for injunctive relief and damages under the Advisors Act in favor of appropriate plaintiffs is necessary to achieve the goals of Congress in enacting the legislation. The decision and the dissent of the Court of Appeals is based on and indeed simply incorporates the decision of the Second Circuit and the dissent in the Second Circuit in a case known as Abrahamson versus Fleischner. As we had occasion to state last March, this case presents a narrow technical question of law and a broad, important question of judicial policy. The narrow question of law presented is whether a private right of action may be implied under Section 206 of the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. The question of judicial policy presented is whether this Court should imply a right of action under the Advisors Act and then leave to further litigation resolution of such questions as who may bring the action, who may be named the defendant, allocations of burdens of proof, the evidentiary standards to be applied, and the damages which may be recovered.
Well, are you suggesting that if Congress did not either expressly or impliedly create a cause of action, this Court could do so?
It's my belief, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, that the Congress has had an opportunity on numerous occasions, both when the Act was originally passed and since that time, to consider and to act on whether or not a private right of action is appropriate here. And as we point out in our brief, on each occasion, it has not created, expressly not created, a cause of action. And for that reason, we take the position that this Court is not in a position to make that judgment, if you will, that there ought to be a private right of action. I might, in further answer to that question, refer back to the language of the Court of Appeals in this case, where the Court of Appeals said that it made the judgment that it was necessary to have this implied right of action in order to carry out the purposes of the Act. And I question, with all due respect, whether this Court is in a position to substitute its judgment, or the Court of Appeals was in a position to substitute its judgment for what seems to be the judgment of the Congress on six different occasions since 1940, that there should not be an express or a right of private action under the Investment Advisors Act.
Didn't Professor Loss in his testimony suggest that Congress should do just that, just leave the matter open and let the courts decide it?
Yes. Professor Loss suggested in his testimony to the committee hearing the legislation that was proposed, I believe, in 1966, that it might facilitate, I think those are his words, implication of a private right of action if the Congress at that time were to add the words action at law to the jurisdiction and venue provision of the statute. But I think that the suggestion that the facilitation would take place is a telling admission that it does not exist otherwise. Now, for this Court to imply a private right of action under the Investment Advisors Act, it would necessarily engender uncertainty as well as cause delay and undoubtedly add to the expense of the parties involved and, in general, frustrate the very right which is suggested here should be implied. And I say that because to imply a private right of action must necessarily, in the context of this case, leave open all those questions which Congress very well could spell out, could delineate, could define, as it did when it created a private right of action under the Investment Company Act in 1970. This engendering of uncertainty comes against a background of statutory language which is unique to the Investment Advisors Act and which confers jurisdiction on the federal courts for only one legal purpose. The jurisdictional provision of the Investment Advisors Act limits the jurisdiction to a suit in equity to enjoin violations of the Act. That language is unique to the Investment Advisors Act, and it is distinguishable from each of the other federal securities laws. The other laws, the other acts, all provide that the jurisdiction shall extend to all suits in equity and actions at law brought to enforce any liability or duty created under each of those acts. The addition of, or the omission of the language action at law brought to enforce any duty or liability, we are told in the case of Touche Ross versus Reddington, ought not to be read as the creation of a private right of action, but we contend that it remains an important indication of congressional intent. Now, the respondent's only explanation for the difference in the language between the Investment Advisors Act of 1940 and the other federal securities laws to which I've just referred is that there was either an unintentional oversight by an unidentified draftsman and that the section itself really has no legislative history worthy of the name. Now, the importance of the Advisors Act special language is reinforced by an examination of that Act's legislative history. Now, like physical anthropologists, the counsel in this case have sifted through the legislative history, the sands and the pebbles, if you will, of legislative history, and they have found artifacts to support their position in each direction. But the important part of that, if that search, or to take the metaphor one step further, that dig is that the proponents of an affirmative private right of actions for damages in this case, or for equitable relief, have been unable to point to any one solid evidence or any one solid piece of testimony or anything that would approach solid indication that Congress intended that the Act serve as a springboard for private actions by disgruntled investors. But there is one other artifact on the other side that we believe to be particularly important, and that is the amendment to the Investment Company Act in 1970, in which the Congress expressly created a private right of action under the Investment Company Act, the companion statute to the Investment Advisors Act. The 1970 amendment to the Investment Company Act added a private right of action to the Investment Company Act, but no private right of action to the Advisors Act. This addition of a private right of action to the Investment Company Act included congressional attention to each of those unknown factors to which I referred earlier. When Congress acted in 1970, it defined the duty or the standard of conduct. It defined the class of plaintiffs, parties who could sue. It defined the class of defendants who could be sued. It allocated the burden of proof. It established the evidentiary standards that must be met by the plaintiff, and it prescribed the damages which could be recoverable.
Haven't some of the decisions of this Court said that what Congress did or didn't do 25 or 30 years after the act on which the party is relying isn't of great significance?
That's correct, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. However, as recently as June, I believe it was, in the case of Touche Ross versus Reddington, this Court ruled that and instructed, if you will, counsel to look to the context in which a statute was enacted or to look to the context in which it appears. The exact words are to call attention to the statutory scheme of which the statute was a part.
But that would be the 1940 Act here, wouldn't it?
Yes. And in 1940, of course, there was no private right of action created under the Investment Company Act either. But I think it's significant that in 1970, in the course of amending both the Investment Advisors Act and the Investment Company Act, that the Congress expressly created a private right of action against certain investment advisors under the Investment Company Act. And it seems to me that that's if Congress had intended that there be, or wanted there to be, if you will, a private right of action under the Investment Advisors Act, that would have been the time to do it.
But Congress have assumed that?
It's possible, Mr. Justice Marshall, it is possible that Congress could have assumed that. However, for Congress to have assumed that, one would have supposed that we could find in the record some indication or existence of that assumption, and there is none. There is nothing in the record to suggest, nothing in the congressional hearings to suggest that Congress assumed that that right existed. And I would further add that if Congress assumed that the right existed, why did it deem it necessary to create the act, the private right of action under the Investment Company Act, in which a companion statute in which it could have just as easily deemed that it existed and therefore it was unnecessary in that instance? To take it one step further, the actions of Congress in 1970 really alleviate the major policy objections that we see to the implication of a private right in this instance, because, as I point out, it does really address all of these very difficult questions having to do with standing, damages, burdens of proof, and so forth. Now,
Mr. Anderson, if memory serves, original argument in this case, there was some discussion about what the question actually was before us. Is the question whether or not there's a private right of action under the Investment Advisors Act, or is the question whether or not there's a private right of action for money damages under that act?
The question before the Court is whether or not there is a private right of action under the Investment Advisors Act. Quite correct that in the first argument there was some question as to whether a distinction should be made. We urge then and we urge now that no such distinction should be made.
Judge Gerfein did make such a distinction, didn't he?
Yes, in a footnote, in a dicta footnote, right. Judge Gerfein suggested that it might be easier to...
Well, it was a dissenting opinion anyway, so...
That's correct.
It was all dicta.
However, we give it due homage because it was in support of our position. The Justice Gerfein's dissent suggested that it might be easier, given the language of the Advisors Act, to imply a private right of action for an equitable action to enjoin.
Right.
But we take the position that the rationale which would dictate a decision with respect to money damages applies with equal force in this instance to the right to equitable relief.
In the present case, Judge Wallace did no more than say that he agreed with Judge Gerfein.
That is correct, Mr. Justice Stewart. That is correct. It was simply adopted the opinion of Mr.
And in this case, of course, it is an action for money damages.
Yes, it is an action for money damages and for equitable
for
relief.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And if I may add to that, the difficulty which we pointed out to the Court last March and which, of course, persists today is that the respondents in this case have asked for rescission and incidental damages. So if, for example, this Court were to make a distinction between legal and equitable relief and to limit it, the relief to equitable relief, I think that the distinction would soon become meaningless for the reason that courts of equity have traditionally been empowered to grant complete relief, including incidental damages, as necessary. Now, there is additional legislative history which clearly points away, in our judgment, from the implication of a private remedy here. But rather than repeat and summarize that history, all of which appears in the briefs, I respectfully refer simply to the fact, again, that neither the respondent nor the SEC have been able to offer any direct evidence that Congress intended to give clients of investment advisors ready access to the federal courts. At best, the respondents and the SEC simply urge an analogy to the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, a different act for a different purpose. Let me turn now, if it pleases the Court, to two principal policy objections to the implication of a private right of action under the Advisors Act. First, if this Court were to imply a private right of action under the Advisors Act, it would undermine, if not destroy, this Court's recognition in 1975 that an investor cannot maintain an action under the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 unless the investor can allege the purchase or sale of a security. Now, according to the respondents and the SEC, merely being a client of an investment advisor, the existence of the relationship, endows that client or prospective client with the right to sue for damages or to seek equitable relief, even though the client or prospective client neither purchased nor sold a security. Let me pose an example. Let us suppose that an investment advisor recommended against the purchase of a certain common stock. Let us further suppose that the client follows the advice of the advisor and does not purchase the stock. Let us suppose that the stock next rises in value. According to the SEC and the respondent, the existence of the relationship between the advisor and the client would give that client the right to file a suit against the advisor and allege that but for the advice, he would have purchased the common stock. Now, the SEC clearly says at pages 41 through 45 of its initial brief, that since the Investment Advisors Act does not have purchase or sale language, we don't need to worry about that. It is not a requirement. The respondent seems to say the same thing. It's pages 60 through 62 of the respondent's brief, although it is less direct. The conclusion is that a client who does not purchase stock would be entitled to maintain an action under Section 206 of the Advisors Act, whereas someone who did not have an investment advisor and was not dealing with an investment advisor would be barred from bringing the claim. The result is, in effect, a discrimination between those who are fortunate enough to afford the services of an investment advisor and those who do not use an investment advisor.
Except, Mr. Anderson, it only applies to investment advisors who defraud their clients.
Absolutely. That's correct. But the point is, I think, Mr. Justice Stevens, is that if the allegation were that they were the victim of fraud with respect to not purchasing, they would have standing under the rationale or the interpretation given by the respondent SEC, by the respondent and the SEC in this case. I think the example well illustrates the extent to which implying a private right of action in this case would undermine the limitation, if you will, that this Court recognized in the Manner Blue Chip Stamp case. Now, the second.
Anderson, do you think the Court has decided any cases since the last argument that have any relevance to the issue you're arguing?
Very certainly, Mr. Justice Stevens.
Are you going to discuss any of those?
Yes. We have commented upon the two cases which seem to be most directly relevant here, namely Cannon versus the University of Chicago and Touche Ross and Company versus Reddington, both of which seem to bear on the question that's currently before the Court. And we have commented on those two cases. I would be pleased to comment here on the impact of either of those cases, if you wish.
Well, no, apparently you don't think they help you very much. I would assume you'd call our attention to it.
Well, I do indeed think that both cases help us.
I may have missed your later brief. That's part of my problem.
There's a yellow-covered brief, I believe, and it includes discussion of both the Reddington case and the Touche Ross case.
Thank you. I just didn't get it for some reason.
We have one from the SEC filed on September 25th.
Yes, and I believe that the Court has a yellow-covered brief also, which includes a supplemental brief that we filed, which is devoted in the large part both to Cannon and to the Touche Ross case. I must say that I think with one possible exception that Touche Ross and Reddington seems to be conceptually identical to the case which is before the Court, and that the rationale of that case would suggest a decision in the petitioner's favor here. The case of Cannon is not inconsistent with a ruling here for the rather, I think, abundant reasons given in that case, such as the existence of a provision for attorney's fees to the prevailing party other than the government, the existence of congressional action following implication of a private right of action, and for all of the reasons given in the majority opinion in that case that the Cannon case is absolutely consistent with a ruling in the petitioner's favor here. Let me now return, if I please the Court, to the second policy consideration which bears on a decision here, And that centers on the special wording of Section 206, the provision of the Investment Advisors Act on which the claim for private right or private relief is based. Section 206 makes it unlawful for an investment advisor to defraud a client or prospective client. The key words are, of course, a prospective client. And this raises an interesting example. Let us suppose that an investment advisor were to send a business solicitation letter or material to a prospective client. Let us suppose next that that material were later deemed or alleged by the SEC to be misleading, fraudulent, deceptive, and so forth. The SEC clearly says at pages 40, 41 through 45 of its brief that this prospective client would have a claim under the Investment Advisors Act, and the respondent is simply silent on the issue. Those who are prospective clients of investment advisors are hardly a discrete class of plaintiffs, but more importantly, the notion that a private right of action could exist in favor of prospective clients at a minimum raises more questions than it could possibly answer. Nonetheless, Section 206 speaks of prospective clients as well as clients. Prospective clients, however, is consistent with enforcement by the SEC going into court and seeking to prevent an investment advisor from sending misleading or deceptive material with respect to investments.
You don't question the authority of the SEC to bring an injunctive action?
Absolutely not. No, and indeed, I think that the duty and responsibility of the SEC is the enforcement mechanism under this Act. But I simply refer to the SEC's enforcement here because that use of the phrase prospective client is consistent with that kind of enforcement, and I submit it is not consistent with the notion of private enforcement.
What kind of relief could the Commission, the SEC, secure?
In the example just given, under the express wording of this Act, they could go into court and seek an injunction to enjoin a violation of the Act.
Only equitable relief.
Only equitable relief, that's correct. The potential reach of a private action under the Advisors Act is illustrated by this very case. I would respectfully remind the Court just what is alleged here. It is alleged here that the advisor to a real estate investment trust has violated the Advisors Act. There is no allegation that the wrongdoing occurred in connection with the purchase or sale of any securities. There is no allegation that the acts of the trustee petitioners constituted willful deception. There is no allegation of intentional concealment of material facts. The complaint is simply a complaint about a relationship between a real estate investment trust and its advisor. And if we take all of those things about which the complaint is not about, I think it's clear to see the fashion or the manner in which it is able to circumvent the limitations that this Court in recent years has imposed upon securities actions. It circumvents, for example, the requirement in Ernst & Ernst versus Hockfeller that there be an allegation and proof of intent to deceive. It permits avoidance of the requirement that there be willful deception, as pointed out in the case of Santa Fe Industries versus Green. Now, in response to these policy considerations, the petitioners offer a series of what amount to reassurances that the courts of appeals will be appropriately guided by recent decisions of this Court and will not go astray. For example, in response to the contention that implying a private right of action here would undermine the purchase or sale requirement, the respondents state at page 58 of its brief, it is fair to presume that the federal courts, in giving proper scope to Section 206, will be appropriately guided, end quote, by the requirement that scienter or intent be an element of the claim.
Mr. Anderson, in the SEC's supplemental brief on pages 2 and 3, in its summary of argument, it says, this Court's recent decisions emphasize that implication of a private right of action presents a question of, quote, statutory construction, citing Tuschauss and Cannon. In resolving that question, the Court has held it is necessary to determine, quote, whether Congress intended to create the private right of action asserted, period, close quote. Is it really up to us then to consider all these policy considerations if Congress has not by implication or expressly created a private cause of action?
No, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. I point out these policy difficulties here to, explain or to elaborate the resulting difficulties that would follow from an implication in this instance. And as we are instructed, this Court is a court to consider policy, and so for that reason I bring it to the attention of the Court. But I want to repeat in direct answer to your question.
Who instructed you that this Court was a court to consider policy?
The question, the Supreme Court of the United States, we learned first in law school and later in review of Stern and Gressman, is to consider all of the reasons which bear on a decision. And it seems to me that the decisions, the blue chip stamp case, those policy considerations were discussed by Judge Gerfein in his dissent in the Abrahamson case, and it is simply here that I repeat them to point out the practical difficulties that follow from that implication. But I do not for a moment wish to suggest that there is any reason here why this Court would want to do anything other than what would be evident from the intent of Congress. And to repeat the basic point here, there is no direct evidence here of which we are aware that Congress intended to create a private right of action. I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Mr. Keesman.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please this honorable court. We, too, think it is appropriate to begin this re-argument by calling attention to what this case is and what, therefore, is actually and necessarily before this Court for decision. This is an action brought derivatively by a shareholder of a real estate investment trust against its investment advisor, certain of the trustees of the trust, the parent of the advisor, and a sister corporation alleged to have been party to the transactions alleged to be fraudulent. Now, in discussing the issues before the court, we are again dividing time with the government, with the SEC. And subject to the court's desires and questions, we intend to focus on the case, what the statute does by necessity, by implication, and the legislative background against which the statute was enacted. The Commission will emphasize, again subject to the Court's questions, the appropriateness within the enforcement picture of a private remedy, the question of the relationship between the administrative machinery and the appropriateness of implication of a private remedy, and the inapplicability of doctrines such as those arising from Amtrak and SIPC against Barber. Again, with the Court's permission, I'd like to point out that this case is, as I argued last spring, in its principal cause of action, classically equitable in substantive form. Now, there's no quibble that merger happened and that merger started out as a procedural doctrine. It's continued to be a procedural doctrine. I think there's also no quibble that the substantive law recognizes in the nature of relief available, in the nature of defenses available, there is still such a thing as a claim equitable in its character, in its substantive character, although one is not demurrable if one pleads a bill in equity in a thing called a complaint. You can't plead latches in a complaint for goods sold and delivered, and you can plead latches in a bill for restitution and rescission. Now, in its primary cause of action, this is a bill for rescission of a contract alleged to be the product of a fraudulent scheme and plan for restitution of the compensation, or at least the excess compensation paid thereunder. It even contains the partial seeds of a partial equitable defense. That is, that the full restitution of all compensation would be something for a court sitting as a court of equity to consider if all of the services rendered could not be tendered back for what they were worth. So what is actually before this court, and what can't be not decided, given that certiorari has been granted, is whether an equitable action arises by necessary implication or proper implication from Section 206 of the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. Now, Cannon against University of Chicago, I think, teaches us that the court against Ash analysis is wholly appropriate to use, But as we were so bold as to suggest in our first brief, the four criteria are not independent. They're not 4 points to count on a scoreboard. The second through fourth illuminate the first. And while there has been a difference in the expression of analysis, this really doesn't differ from what the courts did 100 years ago, at least as I understand it, through our distinguished Dean Thayer, who said the reason we look to imply claims for wrong arising under statutes is because in an appropriate kind of case, and he was talking about the kind of case where a standard of safety or a standard of decency had been established by a legislature, not to do so would be to fail to offer appropriate respect to the other branch of the government. There is no discontinuity between the cases at common law, the cases under early federal statutes, and the case at bar. There is a difference in approach and analysis, perhaps a tighter and more careful view, a greater recognition when it arises of the problems of federalism.
Do you think that possible changes in legislative practices over the period since Dean Thayer was talking might have something to do with this?
To a certain degree, Mr. Chief Justice, it may be that this has become a little bit more of a code nation than it was. That is, that in some cases, and perhaps increasingly, the Congress is willing to take the risk of spelling out all the elements of a special kind of cause of action that it wants to create. But at least in 1940, and I think I only have to speak principally to 1940 and not to 1979, this was not a code country. There were experiments with codes. But as we've argued before, we think it perfectly clear that the Congress created, under some of the Securities Acts, specific hybrid forms of action for specific wrongs, its study of which had given rise to the 1933, 1934, and 1935 Acts. It likewise created certain open-ended provisions, saying again and again in its legislative history, we don't know, for example, what kind of fraud is going to happen. Professor Loss, in one of the treatise sections we cite in our original brief, picks up, I think, the appropriate metaphor for an Oregon state court. That if we codified the law of fraud, that Oregon court said, there's a certain kind of gentleman that would sit up overnight, finding ways to commit the three but not the fourth element of such fraud. A certain amount of open-endedness, a non-codification of the law of fraud, was recognized by the legislature to be necessary to avoid codifying the avoidance of any penalty for fraud.
I wasn't really thinking of the code problem. I was thinking of practical day-by-day, hour-by-hour practices of the Congress of today as compared with the Congress of 100 or even 50 or 30 years ago.
Well, that may be so, Mr. Chief Justice, but with respect to Section 206, we're talking about 1940, and respectfully, I don't think there had been any change, certainly no change that invalidates anything that this court said in Court Against Asher and Cannon. We start with what kind of a statute it is.
Well, for when Congress in one of these cases that we had provided for attorney's fees to be allowed to the private litigant, that was thought to be enough to suggest that it was mere inadvertence that they hadn't provided for an express and explicit private right of action. But otherwise, doesn't the Professor Loss's approach leave an enormous amount of discretion to the courts on what are essentially policy questions?
Well, Mr. Chief Justice, enormous is a question of characterization. I don't think it's a problem here. I don't think it's a problem here because there's a much stronger indication of congressional intention that some private litigation arise from the Advisors Act, directly in the Advisors Act. There is a section, Section 215B, which says that any contract, any practice, the continuation of any relationship that's in violation of any substantive provision of this title is void. The courts, as this court has recognized in Deckert, in citing Deckert in Blue Chip, in other cases, softened the blow of the word void so that it doesn't mean no title may pass and a remote heir of the grantor can't take the land back. But it's perfectly clear, though, the decisions of this court that the least it means is avoidable at the suit of the party deceived or aggrieved. Now, that's right in the Advisors Act. And if one is looking to decide, as this court so often traditionally has done, only the case before it, we respectfully submit that this court would have to nullify Section 215B to say that no private litigation arises out of the anti-fraud provisions of the Advisors Act. This is a much clearer case, we respectfully submit, without other considerations we haven't dealt with yet, than Cannon. In canon, there's a prohibition against any person being discriminated against on several different bases. This court was wise enough to realize that a class of persons discriminated against, even though large, was a discrete class, and that it was right creating language. Here it is said in 206, no investment advisor shall defraud his client. That's a very narrow, discrete class. The legislative history from 1934 to 1940 is replete with indication that the Congress considered those who provide capital to the capital market to be a discrete class in need of special and new protection. By the court and canon standards, 206 is far narrower than 901. Directed not only to a single kind of plaintiff, but to a single kind of defendant. In 1940, it was only registered advisors. In 1960, it became any advisor. As to the prospective client question, I think the answer is simple. Fraud doesn't ripen into a cause of action until at least money passes, until the property is fraudulently taken. Prospective client can easily cover the case where the fraud was in the inducement. As one of the things Congress was worried about, touts and tipsters. The investor sends in his money, gets nothing back. A court might say, well, this isn't an advisor-client relationship. It's attainment by fraud in the inducement or false pretenses. Otherwise, while the petitioners raise the horror of suits by people who get tip sheets and don't do anything, again, this is a fraud statute. We're talking about an economic fraud statute, not a statute for sending bad things through the mail. The problem doesn't exist.
Well, are you saying then that the language of Section 80B-15 about the validity of contracts, every contract made in violation of any provision of this subject, doesn't limit the extent of the private right of action? That someone who just got a tout sheet and did not actually enter into a contract but claimed fraud as a result of it could sue?
No, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, he couldn't have been defrauded in any sense I know in the Anglo-American law. If he parted with nothing in consideration of a fraudulent an inducement that had a fraudulent character to make him become a client of an advisor, what economic tort could possibly have occurred? 215, we say, is a de minimis. That's almost, Professor Loss finally went so far, I think, in his 1969 supplement to remark that the 29B under the 34 Act statute was more perhaps explicit than implied. Well, what I'm arguing, sir, is that there's no question Congress expected some private claims to be made.
What if the sheet had said, don't go to anybody but us, and the private cause of action alleged that he relied on that and went to the people who sent out the sheet, and if he'd gone to somebody else, he would have gotten good advice and made good investments?
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, I think this court and most other federal courts would deal with the reductio ad absurdum the same way this court dealt with the problem presented in Blue Chip. The claim that nothing happened because somebody read something, again, is not traditional fraud or deceit. And I think this court would deal with it, as it said in that case, that there is a level at which the court must consider policy. And again, you can always say, we will do nothing that a rational legislator would not have done. There is that mode of analysis, too. We can say it cannot be that the Congress would have meant for this to occur. And within the rubric and within the proprieties, the courts would dispose of the fellow who said, well, I did nothing. I sat in my room until my money went away. This fellow told me not to invest. I think, again, 215 can be read as solving this case and this case only. This court need not decide any other case at this time. This is not to say that we do not agree with the government and with this court in Touche Ross that to make this perhaps somewhat agonizing distinction, once you look at what 206 does, on the basis of 214 and the omission of the phrase actions at law, probably isn't in keeping with the way jurisprudence has proceeded since merger, and that once equitable jurisdiction attaches, to make the argument that the question of which of a series of alternate remedies that have been recognized as alternate for at least a generation rises to statutory or higher significance is a little bit like trying to write the Declaration of Independence on the head of a pin without a very small needle. We showed in our brief that 214 had no history. We showed that it wasn't looked at, wasn't written up, wasn't marked up. We showed one thing more. We showed that if how it got passed meant anything, it means exactly the opposite of what the petitioner argued. Why? Because the reports that came to the floor on which the majority voted said These contain the usual provisions about jurisdiction, venue, actions. If that meant anything to the 266 votes or as it was necessary to carry the House, it had to mean we're doing again what we did in 1933, what we did in 1934, what we did in 1935, the Holding Company Act, what we did in 1939, the Trust Indenture Act. Nobody suggested to the Senate or to the House there was any difference in the procedural sections of the acts they enacted in 1940. This Court has said more than I think it fit for me to comment on what we do with things that didn't get through Congress but weren't rejected by it. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on why Congress didn't amend. Again, we cover that with considerable thoroughness in our brief. The amendment of the Investment Company Act was a response to a particular scandal and a particular lengthy investigation by the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania on mutual fund fees. And that's all that the Congress focused on, and one of the things they were worried about is a split of decision in the courts, and I think a very difficult decision in the Second Circuit, where the court to do there what it thought had to be done and what Congress would have wanted it to do, had to go back and say, well, we'll raise a private claim for economic mishandling under the larceny statute, which is probably as far as Judge Friendly has ever gone. And perhaps Congress thought, we better nail this down. They're having trouble in the First Circuit, and but the defendants seem to have conceded it. Having trouble in the Second, let's lay it out. And so they did. There was no discussion in the Wharton Report of general problems of other kinds of investment advisors. Things that don't come to Congress's attention, this Court has said for 100 years, aren't part of the history we can interpret. The question has been raised, and we don't think it's a proper canon of statutory interpretation. Will something horrible happen if we read Section 206, Section 215, to create a private claim? Again, the respondent notes that the petitioner has found 15 cases in a dozen years, and that the judicial report tells us that 130,000 federal civil actions were filed last year, de minimis non curat lex. There is no burden. As for the elements of a cause of action, this Court has now spoken as to what the proper elements of an action for fraud are and what they aren't. I can't warrant that all lower courts will understand, but I would be terribly, terribly surprised if I could bring a negligence case against an investment advisor. I really would. Or against an investment advisor who had never entered into a contract and never had a client. I really think that this is more or less asking this Court to not be a court, but to be a third house, to say, well, no, this is the kind of statute we've always done this with before. Congress had to mean that the fellow could sue to set aside this contract and get his money back. But, gee, there might just be so many suits, even though it never happened before, that we better stop it now. I respectfully submit that that is not what this Court has been doing in judicial administration. It has not said that we are not going to enforce federal statutes because it's a problem to enforce federal statutes. As I said last spring, once Congress creates positive law, which I was taught in school means the command creating rights and duties, that the designing of remedies is the historic genius of the courts in this country, in England, and the federal courts as much as the state courts. One recognizes that the courts should not encroach on the province of Congress. But Congress, we submit, expected the courts, certainly in 1940 and right on perhaps until early this summer, with a common anti-fraud statute to do what it had done with other common anti-fraud statutes directed toward classes that the Congress had indicated needed special protection.
But if Congress understands that private actions must be created explicitly, doesn't this problem, the long-range problem, work itself out?
But it won't as to the conditions of people as against, well, who have claims that accrued before the summer of 1979.
That's why I said long range.
Well, in the long range, but I respectfully submit, Mr. Chief Justice, that shouldn't deprive plaintiffs who were hurt in 1973. As the Commission correctly states, if this Court is serving notice on Congress, from now on, except for certain accepted areas, and the Court isn't in canon serving that kind of notice, we will never imply a remedy. You've got to codify the civil law. Then, when that is explicitly done, no subsequent statute could give rise to any right of implication. But I respectfully submit this Court should consider very carefully in terms of its institutional needs whether it really means that except in one or two special areas this must be a code country, that it wishes to create the situation where the gentleman from Oregon, I had read it to before, can have his sport, whether it wishes to try, for example, if it must take on codifying the Sherman Act. That's another statute that many commentators have pointed out has become quasi-constitutional. It's a very short
statute.
There's
no question the Sherman Act, there's a private cause of action. Quite. Here we're talking about the existence of
right.
a private remedy, not
my,
about the element.
My metaphor was only with regard to codifying all of the substantive law, which if the notion is you must codify each private action and each private remedy, because none may any longer arise by implication, then I wonder whether that is really what the court means is the proper division of duties between Congress and the courts. I don't think that's what Cannon says. I don't think that's what Touche Ross says. Touche Ross distinguishes itself, as pointed out in the notes, in that this is a classic and ordinary record-keeping and document filing statute, an informational statute. It doesn't purport to create any right of A vis-a-vis B. It purports to create, can be read as creating, and was read by the majority as creating, nothing more than a right of the government to require A to do something. Now, whether one would have liked to see that swept up in a broader implication or not, I think that has nothing to do with Section 206. I'm merely suggesting, Mr. Justice Rehnquist's response to the question, is the world changing? Will we hereafter require precise codification by the Congress of every substantive right and duty that it thinks ought to exist within the system of jurisprudence, that this may raise more dangers than it cures? I don't deny that at some levels and at some limits that is a difficult question. I suggest respectfully that with regard to a simple section like 206, it isn't. I thank the Court.
Very well. Mr. Ferrara.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The Securities and Exchange Commission would like to talk about the five cases this Court decided last term that bear on this case: Cannon, Touche, Kidwell, Burks against Lasker, Davis. But before I do that, I've listened to Mr. Anderson on two occasions twist this case, and I'd like to respond to a few of the things that he said before launching into my argument in chief. First, somehow Mr. Anderson seems to think that the Touche-Ross opinion decided last term closed Section 214 with some kind of special significance for his case. If Touche-Ross stands for anything, it stands for the fact that jurisdictional provisions like Section 214 create no duties, create no liabilities, and if there are duties and liabilities to be created or to be recognized, you've got to go to the substantive provision of the statute. That's the anti-fraud provision, Section 206 here. I think it's inexplicable that he thinks that Touche-Ross helps his case. Secondly, he, on three occasions of the course of his principal argument, says that there is no indication in the legislative history that Congress affirmatively intended to create a private cause of action. That's not the test. Cannon and Touche affirm that that's not the test. Mr. Justice Stevens, in the course of writing the majority opinion in Cannon, said that that case was atypical. That's the word he used. Atypical in that there seemed to be a rather significant indication of legislative intent to create a private cause of action. And Mr. Justice White, in his dissenting opinion, disagreed with that.
How do you explain your language on page 3 of your supplemental brief, then, where you say that in resolving that question, the Court has held as necessary to determine, quote, whether Congress intended to create the private right of action asserted, close quote?
I'm sorry, I understand the quote. I didn't understand the question.
It seems to me what you were just arguing orally was it somewhat at odds with the language I just quoted.
Oh, not at all. We embrace, as we do in our brief, both the Cannon and Touche standards. We understand that this Court wants to treat questions of recognizing private rights of action under federal statutes that don't expressly provide for one as an issue of statutory construction. And we think that this Court in Cannon and Touche gave us the guidelines to go about the business of engaging in statutory construction. The guidelines that the Court gave us in determining that threshold question of congressional intent are clearly articulated in Touche. Mr. Justice Stevens in Cannon said it's that right duty creating part of the let me slow down. Mr. Justice Stevens said in Cannon that it is that right or duty creating language in the statute that is the best indication of whether a private right of action should be implied. That's the canon of statutory construction that this Court, I think, in both Cannon and Touche, have chosen to determine whether or not a right of action should be implied.
You say as long as you've got the right duty substantive language in the statute, you must find in the statute some affirmative evidence that Congress did not intend to.
I think that's too short a standard, Mr. Justice White. I think that the threshold inquiry is determining whether or not the plaintiff was in the special class. I think this Court said in Canon, we're going to look for the right duty.
If that's all you find in the legislative history or the rest of the statute, and you find no other evidence of any kind except that there's that substantive right or duty, you would say the right is implied.
If this Court would like to say the right is implied, I would agree with it.
I thought that's what you said, though, a moment ago.
No, I say that that's the starting point in determining whether or not a right should be implied.
What else do you need?
Well, this Court has said in Canon and Touche that once you answer that threshold question from the language of the statute itself, then this Court is going to be decidedly receptive to implying a cause of action when it is necessary or at least helpful to effectuating the underlying congressional purposes. That, I think, this Court said in both of those cases is the next step. And we think that this case meets that next step also. Beyond that, the Court has said, if you want to regard it as a sub-step of two, the Court has said that it's going to be decidedly receptive to implying a right of action if failing to do so would undermine a statutory purpose. We think we meet that test, too. Beyond that, the Court said, as a third test, if you will, that it was going to be decidedly receptive to implying a private right of action when an explicit right is created on behalf of a benefited class, but there is not an opportunity for that benefited class to access, to intervene, to activate, to participate in the administrative machinery created under the statute. We meet that test, too. That, I think, is the refocusing, the refurbishing of Court Against Dash that Canon and Touche provide. And I introduced the subject of the Davis case also in my opening remark. We think that that bears on this, too, because as Mr. Justice Brennan pointed out in that case, writing for the majority, the question of whether or not there's a cause of action under a statute is analytically distinct from the question of relief. So all of that Canon Touche language, all of the new mode of analysis to determine whether or not Congress intended a right of action should be implied, all focuses on the question of cause of action, as quite properly it should. Well, continuing, Mr. Anderson also seems to think that, or take some great comfort in the 1970 amendments to the Investment Company Act, creating an express right of action under Section 36B. But he omits to tell the Court that Congress said in both the Senate and House reports, as I recall it, to those 1970 amendments to the Investment Company Act, that it had absolutely no intention to adversely affect implied remedies under other provisions of the federal securities laws, particularly the Investment Company Act, or I think the Investment Advisors Act. He raises the 1976 amendments to the, or proposed amendments to the Investment Advisors Act, but he doesn't tell you there that the Congress considered those 1976 amendments merely to confirm what it understood to be the fact that actions had been implied and properly so under Section 206 of the Investment Advisors Act. Mr. Anderson says that the Securities and Exchange Commission and the respondents in this case seek to imply a private right of action merely by some analogy to the Securities and Exchange Act, an obvious reference to BORAC. Well, that's just not the case at all. We've submitted a 22-page supplemental brief indicating that we're quite comfortable in living under Canon, quite comfortable in living under Touche, quite comfortable in living under Davis, and quite frankly relieved that Burks even helps this case. Mr. Anderson seems to think that the SEC doesn't place great credence in what he calls the policy arguments, that there's no purchase and sale here involved. Well, we think that he says that not only that we don't place great credence to that, but that our entire argument rests on the language of the statute. He says the SEC seems to sit on its hands saying the language of the statute doesn't require a purchase and sale accordingly. All of those marvelous policy considerations that the Court articulated in Blue Chip, marvelous from his perspective, the SEC completely disregards. Well, it's just not true. In Blue Chip, that's to say, this case is substantially different than Blue Chip. Here, there is a clear transactional nexus between the plaintiff and the defendant. I mean, they have a privity of contract between them. They have an investment advisor and a client to that investment advisor, much different than Blue Chip. Here, you have a very definite, limited class of potential plaintiffs, expressly identified in the statute. The statute talks in terms of clients of investment advisors. It's not a statute that talks in terms of the general public, the kind of person who could be sitting by the wayside in a purchase and sale securities transaction that Blue Chip was worried about. Also, there's no remote expectation of contingent liabilities in a case like
that. What about the words prospective client? You don't say much about those in your brief.
As a matter of fact, Mr. Anderson, in the course of his opening remarks, suggested that in the Commission's brief, pages 41 through 45, we embrace the notion that a prospective client should also have an implied right of action. I don't recall that our brief does that. As a matter of fact, the Commission's position is that allegations of fraud presuppose that there has to be the existence of a client-advisor relationship. Now, certainly, fraud can induce a party into becoming a client of an advisor, but the Commission's position, the Commission's view is that before an action can be maintained, a person is going to have to demonstrate that at the time of the action or at the time of the discovery of the fraud, that he was a client.
But there certainly you don't require that there have been a contract?
I'm sorry?
You don't require that there have been a contract?
If you mean a written contract signed by both parties.
I mean a contract is defined in 215.
We think that there has to have been an advisory relationship entered into, a formal advisory relationship, so that you have a client status and an advisor status in existence. The prospective client language, we think, was added by the Congress merely to be able to cover the situation where the plaintiff, before he becomes a client, is induced to become a client on the basis of fraudulent misrepresentations. And that prospective client language is important for the SEC that has, as part of its enforcement machinery, the obligation to go in and bring injunctive actions to prevent frauds that are about to occur. So the prospective client language is very important for the SEC language, but not, we think, particularly relevant to or particularly complicating for this court in determining whether clients should have an implied right of action under Section 206. Finally, let's see here. Having discussed briefly Mr. Anderson's position, I'd now like to return to our argument. As I said briefly in part in responding to some of the points that Mr. Anderson raised, this Court has characterized last term and defined what it calls the threshold question in determining whether a private right of action should be implied or recognized under a federal statute not explicitly providing for one. That threshold question was identified by the Court to be whether or not the plaintiff or the respondent in this case was within the special class meant to be protected by the statute. We think that Section 206 in its language, the language of the statute, the thing that Mr. Justice Stephen, writing for the majority of the Court, said we had to look to, the language of the statute creates federal rights in favor of a particularized class of defendants,
Do you conceive in these kinds of cases the bottom line has to be that we conclude that Congress intended to create a private cause of action?
I not only concede that, I agree with it. That's exactly what this Court has said. Congressional intent.
Why is that essential to, why is that bottom line essential that Congress must intend to create it?
Because this Court has decided that it no longer wants to engage in the policy-based reasoning that got us to Borac, a case that's been characterized, in opinion of this Court last term, as being abhorrent and incomprehensible as a matter of policy. Policy-based reasoning as supporting the implication of implied rights of action is apparently out. Statutory construction and dividing the intent of Congress is apparently in.
Well, let's just assume you find a statute that everybody would agree creates purports to protect a class of people and create some rights in them that somebody's going to attempt to protect under the statute. They're perfectly identifiable and the right is clear. Now, why do you need a congressional intent to create a private cause of action?
Quite frankly, Mr. Justice White, the Commission would be just as happy to have policy-based reasoning.
I wonder what your view of it is.
My view is that this Court was far better suited when it based its implication decisions on the policy-based reasoning of Borac. However, we are perfectly comfortable with having the statutory construction rule that's been articulated in Cannon and Touche, and I'm not the one who said that that determining what the ultimate congressional intent is the proper test. That's the test this Court has chosen.
It isn't a question of jurisdiction, is it?
It is not a question of jurisdiction because it's jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. 1331 and 214.
And the right is stated under the federal statute. Now, why do you need some further license from Congress to get into the federal court?
Well, I think if you're asking me to explain the rationale of the Court's decisions in Cannon and Touche, I would respond by saying, Mr. Justice White, that there's a concern on the part of the Court that it not engage in breaches of what's been characterized as a separation of powers provision of the Constitution. The Court does not want to be in the business of
implying. Just assumes the answer that you can't get into court unless Congress tells you, lets you in.
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
Well,
courts have recognized
rights of action, causes of action, without waiting for Congress to say yay or nay on the subject.
Absolutely. That's correct, Mr. Chief Justice.
The question is whether, in the framework of a particular statute, we are forced to rely on statutory construction and not draw on broader powers.
Mr. Chief Justice, if I could stand up here for another 1 hour and try to persuade you that the rationale of Borak was correct and this Court should be drawing on broader policy-based considerations, I'd love to do so. But I just don't think, for some reason, that it's going to do me a lot of good.
No, the red light doesn't permit you to do so anyway. Do you have anything further, Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, Section 215 of the Advisors Act, the so-called void provision or voidable provision, is discussed at pages 5 through 9 of the red reply brief, and I will not take any time here, but in essence, the argument that Section 215 of the Advisors Act authorizes private actions is based on an analogy to a comparable provision under the 1934 Act, an act which has a statute of limitations provision in it. This section has no such provision in it, and it is the very existence of that statute of limitation which has been used by the courts to justify a private right of action under Section 215. This act is not the 1934 Act. It had a different purpose. It was aimed at a different aspect or segment of the securities industry. The right or duty language, which appeared in both Tuscherawas and in the Cannon case, I submit, can only be one test. It ought not to become another mechanistic tool whereby you look and you find the existence of a right of duty and then automatically turn and decide that there is a private right of action. I hope that this case will clarify for litigants in the future that the existence of a right of duty per se is not the test. The basic test remains the intent of Congress. The Advisors Act, unlike the 1933 and the 1934 Act, does not purport to regulate the marketing
of... If it's clear enough in an act that Congress created some protection for a class of people and created some duties on behalf of one group in favor of another, why do you have to... And then you have the jurisdictional provisions in the federal court. Why do you need some other evidence from Congress... The people protected have to have a right to go into court.
Mr. Justice White, I don't think you do under the example that you gave. The example that you gave was that if it is clear enough in the Act itself that Congress intended to create Act...
I didn't say that. I said that it's clear in the Act that there are some duties created by Congress... some duties placed on one group in favor of another. That's just perfectly clear.
Yes, but...
And they say nothing at all about getting into court about it.
There are any number of federal acts which create rights and duty languages in favor of special classes, and this Court has not ruled that either the party had standing to
sue. Well, I'm just asking you, why do you need some other evidence from Congress that the people protected... have to have a separate license from Congress to get into court?
Because I think that the creation of rights or duties under federal statute could encompass a broad range of statutes and therefore imply causes of action under them. There has to be something more than the simply creation of a right or duty. It has to be something more in the statute to indicate that right or duty could be asserted by the special class sought to be benefited.
Why?
Because otherwise it seems to me that you could not explain such cases as the...
But that's just bootstrapping based on our cases. I want to know about what you...
Well, it seems, again, there are any number of statutes which create rights or duty, or have rights or duty language in them, and to simply use that as the talisman or the basis upon which you are then going to say that because rights or duties are created in favor of this class, automatically that class has standing to sue
some evidence in the statute or its structure or in the legislative that Congress affirmatively didn't intend... That they intended to keep them out of court.
I do not understand in the case of implying causes of action that it's the task of those who are resisting implication to come before the court and offer proof that Congress did not intend to imply a private right of action. Because, Mr. Justice White, it seems to me that there are any number of statutes, as I said earlier, which have rights or duty languages in it in favor of certain specified or identifiable class, but that in and of itself, it seems to be, cannot be used as an automatic or a checklist thing, and furthermore, or to shift in another way, the burden to the parties opposing implication to prove that Congress did not intend. Now, the Advisors Act is aimed at a small, specific segment of the investment industry. And that fact alone, I think, is very important because it makes difficult, at least, all of these analogies to the 34 Act and analogies to the 34 Act, which are the basis of the respondents and the SEC's argument. I respectfully call the Court's attention to all of the arguments that are made under Section 206. All of the arguments that are made under Section 215 are arguments by analogy to the 1934 Act and the 1933 Act. Even the use of Borac, a 1934 Act case, is an indication that what has happened is that there are arguments by analogy. Attention. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
The honorable court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.